At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You made your list, you checked it twice, then you found out there were coupons and a discount flyer. The holiday shopping season has come to town. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Mars. For generations, Mars has been making real chocolate from 100% pure cocoa butter. More at MarsHealthyLiving.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Black Friday. It is the 27th day of November. At least retailers hope it will be a Black Friday when their balance sheets go into the black for the first time all year. Hopes are dim of that happening. But before we head down to the mall, we're going to take a look at another promoter of profligate spending, Dubai. Fallout continues from this week's announcement that Dubai World, the government-run investment firm, needs extra time to repay its debts. It owes at least $59 billion to creditors. And there are now growing concerns that a wave of defaults could be on the way. The White House said today it is closely monitoring the situation. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has the latest.
They may not admit it, but investors around the world are trying to figure out what previous crisis they should compare Dubai's debt troubles to. Is it another Lehman Brothers, for instance? Yos Warso is head of global and wealth markets for Union Bank of California. He says it's not Lehman or even the Asian financial crisis, in part because the risk is spread out.
The exposure is mainly with European banks, Asian banks, and a little bit Middle Eastern banks. The American banks probably don't have as much exposure to it here.
But even a little shock could shake the fragile recovery of the banking system. That's according to Simon Johnson, a professor of international economics at MIT. He says the Dubai debt crisis will be all the motivation Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke needs to keep interest rates low for the foreseeable future.
I mean, Dubai World has run out of cash in a very low interest rate environment, not able to roll over its debt even now. So imagine if interest rates were higher.
But before central banks around the world start developing policy based on this, Christopher Davidson says we should remember Dubai's size. He's the author of Dubai, The Vulnerability of Success.
It's not even a state. It's a member of a federation. The debt it has is very substantial, given the size of its population and the size of its GDP. But compared to other developed countries, it's a drop in the ocean.
Davidson says the biggest losers will be Dubai's neighbors and other emerging economies. He says investors are already punishing borrowers whose ability to pay back their loans are in doubt. Case in point, the price of insuring debt in Abu Dhabi and Qatar jumped this week. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Time's up on your chance to weigh in on the Federal Reserve's proposals to crack down on executive salaries and bonuses at big banks. Today was the deadline for public comment. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports on some surprise supporters of the idea.
The Fed would require big banks to come up with new salary and benefit guidelines that don't give employees incentives to take extra risks. One example is a bonus sometimes offered loan officers who persuade home buyers to take out mortgages with higher interest rates. That puts borrowers more at risk of default. You might think banks would worry about tighter limits on compensation. Not so, says Scott Talbot with the Financial Services Roundtable.
The Fed's approach here is very balanced and is targeted towards those exact practices that cause the problem.
Talbot says banks also support the Fed's pay rules because of what they don't do: put a dollar limit on salaries, bonuses, and benefits.
because that will definitely lead to brain drain or hinder the ability of the financial institution to attract and retain top talent.
Bank consultant Bert Ely can think of one more reason banks are reluctant to be critical. They don't want to look self-serving.
My speculation would be that this is a tough issue for them to comment on because the commenters, the senior executives, would be expressing concern about a personal pocketbook issue as versus the regulation of their financial institution.
The Fed rules would give the central bank veto power over compensation plans at the 28 biggest banks. The rules are expected to be finalized early in January, with a February deadline for banks to come up with new pay guidelines. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
On a shortened day on Wall Street, investors showed their displeasure with Dubai. We'll have details when we do the numbers. All right, time to address the elephant in the room that is Black Friday. You might have gotten the impression from TV that everybody hit the stores early today. But just outside our studios here in downtown Los Angeles, we found some folks who weren't shopping. And we asked them why on earth they weren't participating in the buying binge.
No, you're never going to see me at after the Thanksgiving sale just because too many people. And I don't really look forward to getting everybody something.
I'm not going to shop on Black Friday. Black Friday is too dangerous.
I never go and buy on Black Friday, so I will stay home. You're only saving a couple dollars. Doesn't make any difference.
The lines are too long. It's too crowded. You have to deal with traffic and people, and it's just I don't want to have to deal with that.
Yeah, I'm with that guy. And so are some cities in the San Francisco Bay Area where it is Plaid Friday. That's what they're calling an effort to get shoppers to buy from independently owned small retailers. Rachel Dornhelm tells us these kinds of promotions are often worth the cost to put them on.
Cynthia Bragdon is the owner of Urban Indigo, a small gift store in Oakland, California. As part of Plaid Friday, she's cut all prices in her store 10%, including silver necklaces made by a local artisan from recycled watch parts.
Time Flies necklaces are one of the most popular things she makes.
Plaid Friday is a new initiative by alliances of locally owned businesses to turn Black Friday in their favor. Consumers are being asked to dress in plaid to show support for scores of independent retailers who are offering special discounts today. Bragdon says taking part in promotions like this is some of the most cost-effective marketing she does.
Oakland supports it to the extent that they'll pay for some of the advertising and promotion. So we're getting new customers for very little money.
The city of Oakland is putting $50,000 towards its Buy Local campaign. It's part of an effort to retain some of the estimated $10 million in sales tax lost every year by residents shopping outside the city limits. Other cities also have active Buy Local movements.
Salt Lake City, New Orleans, Tampa, Florida, Raleigh, North Carolina has a new campaign.
Stacy Mitchell is with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. After last holiday season, she surveyed 1,100 small retailers. Those in places with strong Buy Local campaigns reported doing significantly better than independent stores in places without them.
The idea of supporting locally owned businesses had really taken hold in their community, and they felt like it was a real buffer against the worst effects of the recession.
There are now over 130 Buy Local alliances across the country. About 30,000 businesses belong. I'm Rachel Dornhelm for Marketplace.
The second holiday shopping season of the Great Recession, and by most accounts, consumers and retailers are still a little freaked out about the economy. Stores have cut way back on inventory. More people are paying cash for gifts. Who'd have thought? Joining us for the weekly wrap on Wall Street and beyond are business writer Heidi Moore and Felix Salmon of Reuters. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you, Tess.
Good
to be here.
I hope you've fully digested from yesterday.
Just barely.
Well, you know, this week was really all about not just retail, but
Also, Dubai. And I would like to ask you about this first. What does it mean when the Disneyland of countries can't pay its debts, Felix?
It means that you shouldn't be lending tens of billions of dollars to tiny little nations in the middle of the Arabian Peninsula who have ideas above their station and about as likely to be able to pay it all back as Mickey Mouse. I think that in a major global recession like we have right now, huge overambitious property developments are liable to default, and this is what we've seen.
Well, Heidi, considering what we've been through over the last year or so, this monetary-wise doesn't seem to be that big. Is it just going to peter out, or are we going to see follow-on effects?
Yeah, I think in the short term, we are going to see some follow-on effects, inevitably, just because Dubai, as much as it's an imaginary construct and doesn't really exist in any real way, is still a sovereign nation. And so people are questioning the debt of other sovereign nations, especially the ones that are really deep in debt. So people are worried, but we're not really going to see the full effect until Monday.
Well, speaking of waiting to see full effects until Monday, I want to talk a little bit about shopping. Lots being spent on stuff today and through the weekend, but it's kind of a one-time thing, right? I mean, overall, how do you think the consumer is feeling about going into the shopping season, Heidi?
I think that there's actually a little bit more optimism than I thought that there was. And I think you saw a sort of leading indicator in this, in that many states actually reported higher tax revenues. And so that would indicate that people are spending more. And this Black Friday might be the test of it. And I think it actually is the test of a more rational approach to spending, because people aren't as dependent on credit. They simply can't access it. So you'll see what the natural sort of American appetite is for, you know, buying and shopping when you have good sales, or deep sales at least, and not too much inventory. And I think that's the first year that you're going to see that.
Well, Felix, what do you think is the natural American appetite?
Americans, when it comes to Thanksgiving, they, just like anyone else, really, you eat what's put in front of you. And the genius of Thanksgiving is what you put in front of people is way more food than any sensible person would ever eat. And that's a little bit like what's happening in the shops today. They put out an insane amount of stuff and hype it up no end, and anyone with money feels some kind of patriotic obligation to go out and spend it all. And I have a feeling that that's actually what's going to happen to a large degree today, because the panic is over. The recession, believe it or not, is actually over. People are feeling that they don't need to panic anymore, and they can go back to their old ways of spending money.
You know, I wonder, the question was asked about this time last year, which is, is it better for us to be taking a lesson from the economic crisis and not living beyond our means? Or is it still part of our patriotic duty to be propping up the economy by spending? Heidi, do you think we've reached any sort of equilibrium there?
No, I don't think so, because I think what you found is that basically everything is cyclical, including human appetites. I mean, after starvation, there's gluttony, basically. Mm. You know, you don't get to the point where you get used to starving. And, you know, we are living within our means because we don't have any money. So, you know, you can't spend more what you don't have. And since people don't have credit, we've solved that problem.
Well, Felix, what do you think? What's more important, the economy or us as individuals?
Well, the individuals are more important. And I think if you are being sensible this holiday season, you're going to be a little bit prudent and frugal when it comes to spending money. And you're going to appreciate that you don't have a bottomless well of home equity to fall back upon in case you need money. And so in that case, what you really do need is some cash in the bank. And that's bad for the economy because it means they're spending less, but it's good for the individuals. And in the long term, it means that the economy is going to be put on a more sustainable footing.
Heidi Moore, Felix Salmon, happy shopping to both of you.
Thank you very
thank much. Thank you, Tess. You too.
The season for giving, and not just gifts for your child or sweetheart. It's also that time of year to think of those who don't have much or are in need of basics, food, coats, school books, medicine. Given this economy, you might think that only those with the big bucks can afford philanthropy. Commentator Matthew Bishop urges us to think again.
Billionaire philanthropo-capitalists like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are giving away their fortunes to wage war on America's failing schools and killer diseases like malaria. But what can the rest of us do? Those of us who have only a fistful of dollars to give. Bill Gates can make a difference, but can we? Really? The good news this giving season is, more than ever before, that yes, we can. The total amount of money given by ordinary people dwarfs the donations of the super rich. Now, thanks to some recent online innovations, our giving can have a much bigger impact than it used to. If you wrote a cheque or signed a petition, it used to be a hit-or-miss affair. Who knew where the money went, or if the signature was ever read? Now, if you care about Africa, you can help an entrepreneur through Kiva.org. Or if you want to help Asians fight climate change, click on globalgiving.com. Or if you want to help American teachers do better in the classroom, you can go to Donors Choose. What these websites offer is new and exciting ways for donors to see exactly how their money makes the world a better place. Take Donors Choose, for example. You decide what you want to buy. New history textbooks, maybe, or computers, or perhaps sports equipment. Whatever matters most to you. You can also decide whether to give locally or to a school in a poor neighbourhood on the other side of the country. Through donations as small as $25, Donors Choose has already helped 100,000 projects and touched millions of young lives. And you get a report back from the classroom so you know exactly how your money has made a difference. Experienced givers love the way they can now take control of their giving. Even better, these new websites have inspired thousands of first-time givers too. More money, making a bigger difference. What's not to love? So, this giving season, it is not just Bill Gates who knows he's making the world a better place. We all can.
Matthew Bishop is the New York bureau chief for The Economist magazine. His book is called Philanthrocapitalism: How Giving Can Save the World. If you have a comment for us, just drop by our website, marketplace.org, and click on the link that says Contact. Coming up, a closed Chicago community bank that did not fail to make an impact.
It would not be an overstatement to say that Chicago Jesuit Academy wouldn't exist without the generosity of Park National Bank.
But first, let's do the numbers. Concerns over Dubai kicked sand in the face of the markets today. The Dow shed 154 points, about 1.5%, to close at 10,309. The Nasdaq dropped 37 points, almost 1.75%, to finish at 2138. The S&P gave back 19 points, 1.7%, to finish the day at 1091. For the week, the Dow slipped 0.1%. The Nasdaq fell nearly 0.5%, but the S&P actually rose a fraction. As we mentioned earlier, analysts do not think U.S. banks are as vulnerable to Dubai's financial woes as banks in Europe or the Middle East, but shares of Goldman Sachs fell nearly 3%. J.P. Morgan Chase dropped almost 2%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.21%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is distributed by American Public Media. For information about underwriting this or other APM programs such as Marketplace Money, visit AmericanPublicMedia.org. How will climate change affect where you live? Go to marketplace.org/climate and click on the map. You'll also find dramatic photos of the impact of climate change from around the world, plus all the stories from our series, The Climate Race.
Marketplace Datebook. Here's a look at events coming up Monday, November 30th. The long weekend comes to an end as workers return from vacation a little heavier than when they left. If you couldn't handle the crowds on Black Friday, here's your chance to save money on gifts online. It's Cyber Monday. And the 30th marks the 10th anniversary of the Battle for Seattle, when activists took to the streets to protest a meeting of the World Trade Organization. I'm Timothy Beckworth.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. The holidays are generally a great time for movies. You get rollicking, end-of-the-year action flicks and pretentious Oscar contenders like, oh, New Moon? This year's box office is up almost 7% over 2008. Good for the movie theaters, potentially bad for DVD sales. Why? Well, apparently we consumers are no longer willing to pay high prices for home viewing. These days, DVD spells D-U-D for Hollywood. Here with some reasons why is Claude Brodesser-Ackner. He writes about all things entertainment and joins me here in the studio. Welcome back to the program.
Tess, it's nice to see you.
And happy Black Friday to you.
Indeed. Grim, black, dire.
Uh-oh.
Friday.
And from what I understand, that applies to the DVD market.
It is basically a terrible time to be creating content and a great time to be distributing it or exhibiting it.
But how is this possible? Because I've heard for the last several years that DVDs were the savior of Hollywood.
Well, they were. For a long time, Hollywood was powered by this afterburner, which was the DVD,
mm-hmm.
until around 2007 when it kind of stalled. And then things started to dip. Last year, things went down by about 10%. And we can sort of thank Redbox for that. They have sort of led to the commoditization of the movie business.
And remind us what Redbox is?
So Redbox is a company that basically has about 22,000 little kiosks all over America in supermarkets and retail stores and pharmacies where you can, for a dollar, rent a movie.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Well, now I see the problem.
Yes. In fact, not only are people not buying DVDs because they're renting them, as is, thanks to Redbox, but there's also a change in psychology that's happening here, which is that once people get used to paying a dollar for a movie, it's very hard to get them to pay anything else for one.
And then it's very hard to make any sort of profit off of them.
Bingo. So if you are interested in cleaning up on DVD sales, here is an interesting prospect for you. The studio's desperate to make up this shortfall that in the sales of DVDs and eager to introduce some new bell or whistle that will get you to buy DVDs
mm-hmm.
have been fooling around badly with a format called Blu-ray.
Right.
Now, Blu-ray's only in about, let's say, 12% of American homes. And that's because it requires that you go out and buy a new player.
It's pretty expensive, too.
Well, they were for a long time. But in part because of this down economy and in part because of these plunging DVD sales, studios have had to do what they vowed they would never again do, which is cut wholesale prices. And that means that for you, dear shopper, big, big savings are coming. Retailers treat Hollywood sort of like a loss leader. It's just catnip to get you to come in and buy a big screen TV or whatever it is you're angling for in your heart of hearts. But now, a full year before anyone expected this would happen, Blu-ray is suddenly a loss leader. Walmart started offering $9.99 Blu-ray discs last month. Last week, Target started offering Blu-ray at $8.99.
And what did they used to be?
Well, they used to be $25. This was meant to be the thing that would prop up DVD sales. So if a DVD went for $15, which already had Hollywood swallowing pretty hard, a Blu-ray disc was going to be $25 or at least $20.
And now we're at $9.99.
And players, by the way, which used to be these $400 behemoths that nobody wanted to buy, Walmart is now offering a Blu-ray DVD player for $79.
So now we have not only the death of the DVD, but we also no longer have high profits on what is the very latest technology, which is Blu-ray. So how is Hollywood going to make any money?
The problem with your question is that there's not really a good answer.
There's nothing in the pipeline.
In the short term, And in the long term, we're trying to figure that out. So you see companies like Sony, which is expected to make a deal with Nintendo's Wii. The idea is to get people who are already owning video game consoles, which are enabled to connect to the web, to download movies that way and to stream stuff. But that's down the road. It'll be a while before most people can get a movie that way.
In the meantime, bargains for the rest of us.
Yeah, exactly.
Claude Brodesser-Ackner is an entertainment writer here in Los Angeles. Thanks so much for coming in.
Good to see you, Tess.
124 banks have failed so far this year. Nearly every week, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation announces another round of closures. The most recent was Commerce Bank of Southwest Florida, which the FDIC sold to a bank in Minnesota. Sometimes changes in ownership can be pretty painless for bank customers. One day you bank with Washington Mutual, the next day it's Chase. But as Chicago Public Radio's Adrian Hill reports, there are times when a bank's closing prompts an entire community to take action.
Bankers don't have a lot of friends these days. We've heard stories of corruption and greed, tales of poor judgment and big bonuses. But this is a different sort of story, about a community bank with a long history of lending to poor neighborhoods in and around Chicago's South and West Sides. Park National Bank was shuttered at the end of October, along with 8 sister banks across the country, all owned by the same holding company. Under a deal with federal regulators, the banks were immediately acquired by U.S. Bank Corp. They reopened the next day as U.S. Bank branches. Despite that, protesters have taken to the streets.
Too good to fail.
Park National Bank. Too good to fail.
Why all the love for a bank?
The commitment that they've made to supporting neighborhoods and the people in particularly underserved communities is striking. It's an incredible example for all of us.
That's David Pope. He heads the elected council for Oak Park, a Chicago suburb. Pope says Park National did things like give free space to a local Head Start preschool, give money to social service groups, and lend money to schools. One of those schools is Chicago Jesuit Academy, a private middle school on the west side of Chicago where every student is on scholarship. When I'm there, late in the afternoon, it's extracurricular time. New musicians are learning to play B-flat. Matthew Lynch is president of the school.
It would not be an overstatement to say that Chicago Jesuit Academy wouldn't exist without the generosity of Park National Bank.
A few years ago, Park National gave the school a $4.2 million zero-interest loan to buy and renovate its building.
We were a new school on the west side of Chicago with no credit history, but the bank saw in us great promise and great potential.
Park National also gave the school a $1 million gift, of which the school has received a little less than half. Now, with the bank's closure, the future of that gift and what comes next for all of the groups supported by Park National is up to U.S. Bank Corp., which took over Park National's assets. Lisa Glover is the Director of Community Affairs for U.S. Bank.
What we're trying to do is get out and just talk to everybody who had a relationship with Park National. Obviously, they had an enviable record of community service and involvement, and we're trying to understand that.
Glover says U.S. Bank hopes to make decisions about its own investments by early next year. In the meantime, bank supporters have created a group they're calling the Coalition to Save Community Banking and asking a congressional panel to look at how and why Park National was closed. Especially galling to protesters is that Park National was relatively healthy when it was seized. Regulators shut it down using something called cross-guarantee liability. Basically, some of Park National's sister banks, other banks owned by the same holding company, were undercapitalized, and the government decided it had to take down the good banks with the bad. In Chicago, I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, if you've ever wandered through a zoo and wondered what it'd be like to be stared at through a cage all day long, two animals at the Warsaw Zoo in Poland could tell you. Really, they could open their mouths and speak to you about it. A week-long special exhibit features two Homo sapiens, a man and a young woman dressed in animal skins, staring out from behind bars. It's a marketing effort for a play called Caveman. No word on whether they'll be fed by zookeepers and encouraged to mate to produce offspring. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 154 points, about 1.5%. The Nasdaq dipped 37 points, almost 1.75%. The S&P 500 dropped 19 points, 1.7%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up on our weekend show, Marketplace Money, Americans fall hard for advertising and we shop till we drop. But is that just a stereotype?
I think a great many of us deserve more credit, though not necessarily a greater credit limit.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that this weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.